The Bane Free Radio Hour.
Welcome back. I'm Sean Hazlett, and I am here with the Bane Free Radio Podcast Hour, or the Bane Free Radio Hour Podcast. And I'm here with Simon R. Green. Simon, welcome, my friend.
Hi, great to be here.
We had a bit of a fun time making this happen, so if people don't see your face, that's why. I feel like I tried... I almost was able to figure out how to call you from Zoom, but we didn't get that far. I think you figured out how to call into me, so that worked.
Clearly, far too handsome for Zoom, and I overpowered the cameras.
Yeah, your stunning visage would have blinded the audience, and they would only have been staring at you rather than listening to this book you have out. So speaking of which, Hide and Seek, yes. The second in the series. Before I get into all that, just if you could tell folks briefly, very briefly, your background, and then we'll get into the book.
Okay, I started out, my first novel was published in 1988. I did the Hawk and Fisher series, which is basically a couple of beat cops working in a Lord of the Rings star city. I moved on from that to doing the Deathstalker series. That was epic science fiction. I did the Nightside books, which was a private eye Roberts in the Twilight Zone. Basically, I have been making a living in this game for 35 years now. I've just handed in my 81st novel.
Oh, wow.
And I did one film, which was a low-budget British horror movie called Judas Ghost, which I was very pleased with, but didn't actually go anywhere. That's life.
Well, it's also Hollywood, right? Or, you know, the film industry.
I swear to God, we'd sold the rights to do a TV series at Universal for the Nightside books. We had John Carpenter attached to direct the pilot.
And it didn't happen. He is my favorite director.
I love that guy. I really wanted to hear the musical theme he would have written for the Nightside.
Seriously, right?
There was an interview with him in Variety magazine where he said, my next project is going to be the Nightside, and I'm really looking forward to it. I was so made up. But it didn't happen. Nobody could explain why. It's a bit like the end of Chinatown, where they all just say, it's Chinatown, and you walk away.
Yeah, it's Hollywood. Yeah. And the other thing, too, is they're always effusively positive, right? Oh, this is definitely getting made. This is going to be the greatest film of all time. It's the best ever. You're brilliant. You know what you're... And then, like, crickets. That's just Hollywood.
The world and everything that's in it, right up to the point when they stop taking your phone calls.
And it's passive aggressive too. It's very like, look, I'm a East Coast plant transplant into California, and no one wants to upset anybody here. So they're very, you know, it's a very indirect culture. It's very passive aggressive. Whereas where I'm from, you know, the East Coast, it's very aggressive aggressive. People will tell you to F off right to your face. And, you know, it's good. It gives you a sense of what, so sometimes I can be like a bull at a China shop out here, but you know, it is what it is. But Hollywood's very much that way because they don't want to upset people because they know that they might work with you in the future. And if you become big, they don't want you to have a negative memory of them. And, you know, I see it as kind of cowardly behavior, but that's just me. Anyway, I digress. So yes. Let's get into Hide and Seek.
I always say, I'm a writer. I write novels. That's my bread and butter. Anything else is jam, but I can live on bread and butter.
That's right. That's all you need. That's all you need. All right.
Yeah.
So Hide and Seek, let's go all the way back to the first book, just so that we can paint a picture of the, just high level without giving too much away, about where our protagonists start, given what they've been through. So just kind of what they've been through.
Okay. The first book was all about whatever happened to all the old monsters. At the end of the 20th century, everybody believed in vampires and werewolves and ghouls. Then you get to the beginning of the 20th century and nobody believes in them anymore. I thought, what if they disappeared into the underworld of crime and allowed themselves to become fictional? All except for one who refused to be anything but a plain-dealing monster, and that was Edward Hyde. So by default, he becomes the one force that's still fighting monsters to protect humanity. Dewey sets up Jekyll and Hyde Incorporated, handing out the elixir to suitable people to make his army to fight the monsters. In the first book, our hero takes the potion, becomes a Hyde, and with his new partner, Tina Hyde, they basically wipe out the monster clans. Mm-hmm. But nature abhors a vacuum, supernature mm-hmm. even more so. There's a power gap. So I thought, whatever happened to all the old aliens? The Martians, mm-hmm. the bug-eyed monsters, the reptiloids and the grey, they move in to take over. And our two heroes are all that's left standing between them and humanity. But the aliens are much more aggressive. They've seen what the Hydes can do. So the book starts with a fleet of helicopter attack ships strafing a rooftop and blowing the hell out of our two main characters. Think of the ending of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. That's where the book starts. Unfortunately, Hydes are made to take punishment. They survive and they say, right, the aliens are going down. And the whole book is about them taking on one alien base after another, protect humanity, and take their own personal idea of revenge.
So when you're coming up with your concept for the quote-unquote aliens, how did you approach that in terms of the research and things like that? Because I noticed you refer to greys, reptoids, Martians.
I went back to the original. I mean, I went back to H.G. Wells for his Martians. I went back to the old pulp stories for the bug-eyed monsters and the lizardy aliens. And the only recent one I went with was the greys, because I had a whole new take on what the greys are and what they're about. But the whole point of doing the Hyde book is to take traditional, well-known characters and approach them from a whole new angle, so that you're not seeing the same old, you're getting something new, something different. And this book particularly is much more an action book. It's much more about, we've had enough, we're not taking any more of this, you guys are getting it. There's no subtle planning, there's no deep involved plots. It's, we are Hydes, we are here to beat the hell out of you, and they do.
And in terms of kind of prominent themes in this series, or let's say series first, and then specifically in this book, what sorts of themes are you trying to explore?
Well, what it's about is, as I say, it starts out with Edward Hyde is the only one who's running his organization, but he was famously the most evil man in the world. He's not doing this out of any sense of goodness. As we go mm-hmm. through the first book, our hero discovers that he's not in the story he thinks he's in. He's a man who's taken a potion that's turned him into a monster. And he's clinging to his humanity while still fighting the good fight. And he's trying to destroy monsters without himself becoming a monster in the process. And also trying to save the soul of his partner, Tina Hyde, who has gone further down the dark road than he has. And as he slowly falls in love with her, he's trying to bring her back into the light. And in the second book, the background is them building their relationship together as they strive to fight monsters without becoming monsters, to fight the aliens without becoming worse than they are. At the end of the day, if they destroy the aliens but become a bigger threat, they've lost the battle. There is the constant struggle of what they can and cannot allow themselves to do as they cling to what's left of their humanity.
Now, there is some sort of a tension in the beginning between Daniel and Tina, in which Daniel kind of has this desire to kind of rebuild the Jekyll and Hyde organization. Well, let's just start with there. Like, what is the Jekyll and Hyde organization, and what happened to it, and kind of what are their two various perspectives on kind of what to do with it?
Right. As I said, Edward Hyde created it so that he could have an organization that would fight the monster clans. He could only hand out the elixir to a small number of people because it killed most of the people who took it, because it was only ever tailored to Dr. Jekyll. Now, he built an organization of support a bit like in the Bond movies, where you've got Q and you've got the backup and all the rest of it, the intelligence gatherers. And the Hydes are the Bonds, the 00 people who go out and actually have a license to kick monster ass. In the first book, by the time you get to the end, Daniel and Tina discover Edward has his own agenda and it's not a good one. And they turn on him before he can turn on them. And the organization, of course, sides with Edward. So they actually have to destroy the organization that they were working for. In the second one, they realize, you know, having been faced with an attack by a fleet of helicopter gunships, they need the organization back. And they have to rebuild it by going out and finding people that they can trust to rebuild the organization, while at the same time making sure it doesn't go down the same bad route that the first one did.
Well, especially since once people take this elixir, right, they change. If you'd say more about
that. Oh, God, yes. The whole point is, you don't just take the elixir and suddenly you're big and strong and fast. You are a Hyde. It's constantly appealing to all the darker parts of your heart. Now, Daniel, in the first book, was a police officer who'd gone undercover and found himself taking on a monster clan. And basically, he and all his fellow officers were slaughtered. He was the only survivor. He came out of it crippled. He got kicked out of the police force because he kept talking about monsters and no one would believe him. So when he's offered a drug that says it will cure everything that's wrong with you and make him strong, he doesn't think twice. Here's a chance to be fit again and to take the fight back to the monsters who hurt him. But the elixir is constantly pushing you to the dark side. It's a constant struggle to maintain a balance between what he wants to do and what he's being driven to do, hanging on to his humanity despite what he's being pushed to do. And I think what, in a sense, what saves him is Tina. Tina has gone farther down the dark path. He can see what's happened to her. And because he's fallen in love with her, he's determined to save her. And by saving her, he's saving himself. I think that's what gives the book its spine. That's what keeps you going. Seeing, are these two lost souls going to save each other?
And in terms of the elixir, you know, how is it constructed? What properties does it have? Are there kind of mystical properties to it, or is it kind of sort of standard chemical reaction?
I've always been a big fan of the original novel, which is very different from a lot of the film and television and spin-offs that have come since. There's a tendency these days when they do Hyde to make him like an anti-hero, and he isn't. Hyde, when we first see Edward Hyde in the book, it says he is the most evil, hateful, destructive creature you can conceive of. Just to look at him makes you want to kill him. He is so vile and awful. And it's one of the great mysteries of the book. Why does the saintly, heroic Dr. Jekyll want to create a potion that brings out the worst in a man? Never made clear. So I thought, what if he actually set out to do something else? But it took him by surprise. Instead of making him into the better person he thought it would, it appealed to the id, to the unconscious, to all those unspoken, repressed Victorian desires. They come to the forefront, and they make him into Hyde. So I said the elixir. It's not the original elixir. That was used, all of it, to make Hyde. And famously, the book is about trying to recreate it, and Jekyll fails again and again. So what Edward does is to use his own DNA to reverse engineer something like the original elixir, which produces something which isn't as strong and as extreme as the original, so that the people he creates, the Hydes he creates, aren't as bad as he is. That's why Daniel and Tina can still fight to save their souls.
Now, in terms of this, you know, they have this elixir, and it's obviously a carefully kept secret. In terms of how many people, you know, survive the experience, what's that proportion typically like?
Okay, we're going to do a bit of a spoiler now. So stick your fingers in your ears if you don't want to know.
Yeah, not too many, because I keep asking very spoiler-like questions, so my apologies.
Okay, but basically, at the end of the book, there are only two Hydes left. and that's Daniel and Tina. Everybody else has died in the first book. They are the only two surviving Hydes. Edward Hyde is dead because they killed him for being a complete swine. He had his own plans, and they were really more monstrous than any of the monster clans. But Daniel and Tina are the only surviving Hydes. There is no more elixir. There's not going to be any more Hydes. So part of the book is them trying to decide, what are we now? What do we want to be? What do we want to do? What do we want to become? And fighting the various alien bases, the things that they do and the things that they have to do teach them what their limits are. There comes to points in the book where they simply say, well, I could win by doing that, but I'm not going to do that. We have to find a better way. And sometimes they will go around the houses rather than do the straight direct way, because that will save them at the end of the day.
Now, a big part of this story is your two protagonists have to kind of straddle the line between kind of violence and then madness, right? You know, some of the violence is going to be necessary, but at some point...
There is no doubt that these are two very violent individuals. I saw them in a sense rather like the Incredible Hulk, that, you know, they just because they can do something, they sometimes feel, I have a right to do this. And when they get angry, boy, that, you know, it's really like throwing a grenade into a crowded room. You know, they will explode, and it's like, get out of the way while you can. But this also, the rage, the anger, the strength fuels them, makes them more extreme personalities. Neither of them are interested in being subtle anymore. They will do, it's like you're saying, you know, it's East Side. You know, we are not passive aggressive. We are going to punch your lights out if you even look at us in the wrong way. And one of the subtexts, as we go through the second book, both of them, are, because they don't have the organization, they're having to rebuild it, they reach out to people they used to know in the past. Daniel reaches out to people he knew when he was a cop. Tina reaches out to people she used to know in the intelligence community. And they're not doing it in a sense of, hey, remember me, I was your pal. It's a case of, we're Hydes, do as you're damn well told. Of course, this can only go well. But the very fact that they are extreme personalities, I think, makes them very attractive characters. There's no side to them. There's no time when they will say, well, I could do this, but I'd better not. They just do what they're driven to do. In the first book, I actually did a sex scene where it was important, I felt, to show that Hyde's emotions are bigger than ours, more extreme than ours. Even their sex is more than ours. They break the bed and break the whole bedroom in the process. And I think seeing people being pushed to their extreme makes them much more interesting characters.
Well, just even grappling with it, too. And
oh, God, are there any... like...
Yeah,
they're like
go
a force.
Ahead.
Once you let them go, they're like a force of nature. You do not get in the way of a tornado. They will just keep going.
And let's kind of go to Tina. You said she comes from the intelligence community. If you give the audience a little bit of her background so that people have some context.
Tina started out as a party girl. Never met a drink or a drug she didn't like. Result, she ended up hopefully addicted. She was destroying herself. And when a member of the intelligence community found her, she was actually dying after trying to slit her wrists. He saves her, takes her to Edward Hyde. He gives her the potion. It makes her a Hyde. And he essentially loans her out to the British intelligence community in repayment. So she has this background. But when she goes back to the people she knew, she spent so long as a Hyde, they barely even recognize the person. She's so much more than she was.
Mm-hmm.
But they see her again as a potential asset, and they're trying to use her while she's using them. And that's one of the few places which I think is actually quite sad, that she has destroyed her old relationships by becoming what she's become. And she genuinely misses the people she used to know and the person she used to be. I think that's part of what brings her back into the light.
Now, when they start or when the book starts, the whole aliens thing is like a bolt from the blue, right? They're kind of raiding through Edward Hyde's office, and they kind of come across this information.
Yeah, the feeling was right at the beginning of the book that they're talking about, we've wiped out all the monsters. What do we do now? We're Hydes. We're not made to be subtle. We're made to be violent, to fight the good fight. What do? We don't have an enemy anymore. And opening the files tells them that there are these aliens out there, and the only thing that was keeping them from invading humanity was the monster clans. The monsters said, "No, this is our territory. Stay out." But they're gone now. And at first, Daniel and Tina's reaction is, "Great, we've got someone else to fight." And then the attack fleet turns up and shoots the hell out of them. And they realize, ah, this isn't going to be as simple as we thought this was. And as they go through fighting one set of aliens after another, they really have to dig deep to find reserves they didn't know they had, to be stronger and tougher and more determined than they thought possible, because they're really getting the hell knocked out of them along the way. And in a sense, the first book was almost too easy for them. They defeated everything they came up against, and it gave them this false confidence. The second book is them learning, we can do this, but we've got to be better than we were. And bit by bit, they become better, they become stronger. So when they get to the end of the second book and they say, what do we do now? They're in a much different place than they were at the beginning of the book.
Now, as you think through the alien species that you've created, right, for this book, what would you say kind of the strengths and weaknesses of each, what about them is the greatest threat? What about them? Well, I probably don't want to say weaknesses because that might give away too much, but go ahead.
Basically, all the aliens have the same base of operations. They're here to invade. They want our territory. They don't care about us. We're just in the way. They'll wipe us out quite happily. But they've all got different approaches. The Martians, in the first book, it's made very clear they eat human flesh and drink human blood. And that they just see us as cattle. When you're looking at the bug-eyed monsters, they see us as they have organic technology. So they see us as spare parts. They can take us apart and plug us in. You get to the reptiloids, and they basically just want us gone. We're just in the way. When you get to the greys are much more into infiltration. They can make themselves look like people, a kind of super hypnosis. They've been infiltrating us for some time. Their idea is we will become them. They will turn us into greys. So they're going to not just destroy us, they're going to replace us. So each one has to be faced in a slightly different way. And again, we're heading into spoiler territory. One of the things that the Tides actually have to do, they say, these aliens are so powerful, we're going to need help. What other kind of aliens are there that just might come to our assistance? And that's when I started reading H.P. Lovecraft's old stories.
Oh man, the old gods, huh?
Oh, yeah, because after all, this was their territory originally. They're not going to look too good on a bunch of newcomers coming in. So the idea is, can they make a deal with the Elder Gods just in case to back them up? So
That nicely sets up the third book because that's never a good strategy in anything in H.P.
well,
Lovecraft, is to deal with
you
the
get to the end of the
gods.
second book, and it does pay off very powerfully. But there is enough left open. If this book sells well enough and Bay wants a third, I have a plot ready to go. That one will be called Hide in Plain Sight. But we'll have to see how the second one does. But I've always been a great believer in you always leave a few threads hanging so you've got somewhere to go.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, which authors in, growing up are some of your favorite? Even today, which authors do you still enjoy reading?
Okay, when I was younger, I was a huge fan of Leslie Charteris, who wrote the Saints novels, because I was watching Roger Moore as a saint on television, and my dad said, "You do know there's books?" I said, "No," and he had a whole bunch of them that he'd read when he was younger, and I read them and loved them. And what I loved about the saint was he would do anything. He would do crime, he would do horror, he would do fantasy, science fiction. The saint encountered every kind of genre fiction under the sun, and he could do them all and be funny while he was doing it. And I thought, great, you can put it all together. Later on, I loved writers. When I discovered science fiction in a big way, I loved people like Roger Zelazny, Samuel Delaney, Harlan Ellison, all those guys, who would take familiar science fiction fantasy tropes and show you whole new ways to approach them. Mm-hmm. Then, of course, he went into cyberpunk. I loved William Gibson with his whole new approach. These days, it's getting harder to find what I think of as the good stuff, because so often I'll get a book off the shelf and go, well, this is a good idea, but I've read this before and done better. But there are still really good books out there. There are still people I like. But I would have to say my all-time favorite novel is called A Face in the Frost by an author called John Bellairs. Now, he was most known for writing young adult books, The House with the Clocks and the Walls, those stories. But he did one fantasy novel for adults, and that was A Face in the Frost. And it's one of the funniest, scariest, well-written books I've ever read. And if ever I've got a model for what I do, I think that book is it. Because it taught me how you put things together to keep the funny stuff still funny and the scary stuff still scary, and they don't undermine each other. If I can move into films, a good example would be, say,
absolutely,
when I was a kid, one of the first horror stories I ever saw on film was Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. My parents thought, oh, it's a comedy, he can watch that. And I'm going, ooh, monsters. And what I love about it is the funny stuff is funny, but the monsters were played perfectly straight. And it's the two sides don't undermine each other. They actually support each other. A more modern version would be American Werewolf in London, where, again, the funny stuff is funny, but the horrific stuff was genuinely horrific. And in the Hyde books, there's quite a lot of humor. There's a lovely bit where the two Hydes are looking into the archives of the organization, and they find this rather large coffin-shaped thing. And they're told, well, we always test our drugs on animals first, don't we? And inside the coffin is this rat that Dr. Jekyll gave the elixir to. Mm-hmm. And basically, Edward Hyde had nailed it up for about 60 years, and it's still in there, and it's still alive. And when it gets out, it's got a lot of catching up to do. Mm-hmm. So that's funny and scary at the same time.
Yeah, I'm sure it'd be very hungry.
Oh, it is so upset, you would not believe it.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, again, it's like a rat in a cage, right? It's a common cliche. Now, where do you think this series is going? And, you know, we talked a little bit about the cosmic horror aspect. Mm. When you use,
I think
when
I think of the third book, I'm thinking in terms, in the first book we had, they joined the organization, found it was corrupt and had to destroy it. In the second book, they discovered they can't do it without an organization. They've had to rebuild it. Mm-hmm. I thought the third book might be, what happens if the organization, now that the aliens and the monsters are all gone, what if the organization decided, we don't need the two Hydes anymore, and kick them out? And they're run, being chased by absolutely everybody. Where are they going to find new support, new allies? Because they know they made this deal with the Elder Gods, which they thought had worked out really well, but now they're starting to worry, did we actually let the genie out of the bottle here? We've got to do something, and we've got to persuade everybody that we're the only two people who can do this. So the third book would be about the two of them on their own, basically trying to stand up and say, look, we're what you need. You have to support us. And they have to prove it. I think it'd make an interesting story.
Certainly, certainly, certainly would. In terms of H.P. Lovecraft, right? I mean, you're obviously considering playing in that mythos. What are some of your favorite H.P. Lovecraft monsters, stories, all the above?
What I liked, I mean, I've got the complete Arkham edition, so I read them back in the 70s, and I've had numerous editions down the years. I've now got the Arkham ones, which is the, complete ones. Well, I actually liked it better when he was building the mythology, and it was all hints and whispers, and you had to put the pieces together to work out what was going on. Because Lovecraft always said, we are not capable of appreciating or understanding what these elder creatures were. They are so far beyond us, all we can do is like, see like glimpses of them from a distance. And if they decide they're coming, breaking back into our reality, even the strongest hide is not going to kick them out. That's why they're going to need allies. They need a new way of thinking, a new way of working. And like I said, you've got to find the allies to help them do this. Because the monsters and the aliens had one thing in common. They all had sort of human aspects that we could understand and appreciate. We didn't like what they were doing, but we could see why they were doing it. The Lovecraft mythology was so far beyond us, we cannot hope to even comprehend what they are, never mind what they're doing and how they're doing it. You've got to find a way to keep them out, which is not going to be easy.
That's certainly not for the faint of heart, for sure. Now,
Oh,
what do
the
you
third one
see?
is going to be super scary.
Say more when you say super scary.
Like I said, in the first book, they beat the hell out of monsters. In the second book, they beat the hell out of the aliens. You can't just punch Cthulhu in the face and hope for the best. You're going to have to find a better way. And that means moving into more conceptual areas of horror. The scariest thing about, I mean, Cthulhu, for example, in Sunken Aliyah, dead Cthulhu lies dreaming. But that is not dead, which can eternal lie, and with strange aeons, even death can die. When you've moved beyond life and death, I mean, where does that leave a hide? That's all they think about. Going to be interesting.
Yeah, a little bit of an ontological dilemma, let's just say. Right? You're moving to fight entities that can warp the very nature of reality and time. And, how do you even begin to engage in that?
Well, like I said, it depends on how the second book sells. Let's see what that one does first.
Yeah, so people who are watching this podcast need to go out and buy it. And it came out on May 7th, correct?
Just out
And then
now, free, now I'm out in hardback. Buy two, buy one for a friend.
and buy early and often, obviously,
That's the
particularly in
one.
stores. Go to stores and buy it because
I
that'll
would
show
say the
up.
hide and seeks are fun. You will have a good time with these books.
And they're very quick reads. Like it's you write in a very it makes it very easy for someone to read it quickly. You're not stumbling around. There's not like, three paragraph sentences and things like that that some authors do that make things, just it's very easy to get through. So I
Like I said,
definitely
I've been
recommend.
doing this for some time now, but I mean, I always took my model from professional athletes who said the greatest effort goes into making it look effortless. And I do, and I write and rewrite and polish and rewrite more to make it look like I'm just sitting there telling you a story. But I've gone to a lot of effort to make it seem that smooth and that easy and that much just basic fun to do.
And when you were coming up for ideas for this series, how did it come to you? Like, how did you, were you deciding and did you want to write this book specifically, or did you kind of brainstorm?
Okay.
What's your process?
The first book came from a joke. I was in the Worldcon in 2019 in Dublin, and my American agent was saying to me, I need some high concepts from you that I can, because we were looking for a new American publisher at that point. And he looked at me and I said, high concepts, okay. Jekyll and Hyde, together they fight crime, the ultimate buddy cop movie. And he looked at me and said, there's something in that. And I went, really? And I went home and sat down and wrote it down and looked at it and thought, well, not quite that, but a Hyde who fights crime. Why would a Hyde fight crime? Then I thought, well, what kind of crime? What about monstrous crime? What if monsters were... And basically, one thing led to another, led to another. And it tied into, I have a huge affection for the horror movies that I grew up watching as a youngster, late-night television, the old Universal monsters, Frankenstein, The Mummy, Dracula, all those wonderful black-and-white movies. And I wanted to go back to those monsters and have fun with them, back before they became overly complicated and new wave and new this and new that. Now, let's go back to the originals, when they were genuinely written to scare the hell out of the readership and the viewers. And that was where it started. And that led me to the monsters that I grew up enjoying in films and books and television, and saying, let's go back and treat them when they were taken seriously. It's been a long time since anyone took the monsters from H.G. Wells' Martian seriously. It's mm-hmm. That book is now seen essentially as his criticism of British imperialism. Wouldn't it be terrible if somebody came to us and did to us what we've been doing to other countries? Well, yes, that's the subtext. But really, it was about monsters invading our world. That was what it was all about. And I wanted to get back to that basic thrust of, here are terrible, horrible monsters. They have to be stopped. How are we going to do it?
Now, you're talking about movies, and we talked about John Carpenter at the very beginning of this show.
Oh, yeah.
What's your favorite John Carpenter film, and why?
Okay, the one I've seen most often is The Thing, which I saw when it first came out, and I came out of the cinema looking like someone had hit me over the head with a 2x4. It had a huge impact on me. But the one I go back to most, what I think of as my comfort horror movie, is The Fog, because I love the characters in that. They are simply, I love all the people in it. I love the settings, the whole Wadiga Bay, and that whole sense of there's something in the fog. I love all that. I mean, yes, I love Halloween. Who doesn't? I love the later ones. The Prince of Darkness, which, you know, is a very Nigel Neal Quatermassy style piece, very conceptual horror. And In the Mouth of Madness, which is a wonderful...
Oh, yeah.
Really,
about that
it's
one.
A love letter to Stephen King's fiction, if you think about it. But,
and
I mean,
H.P.
Lovecraft, pretty much,
right?
Oh, God, yes. But, I mean, I've seen pretty much everything he's done is film. He did a wonderful television show for the Masters of Horror series called Cigarette Burns, where a guy is tracking down a lost
did that
horror
one?
movie.
Yeah, it's the horror
that
movie
was
with
him.
the angels in it or something like that.
Oh,
I didn't
is
know
a
it was
cracker of a piece.
Yeah.
I mean, it's only about an hour long, but it's like got 3 hours worth of material crammed into it. So yeah, Carpenter has always been one of my great heroes. I'm just still mad as hell we never got to work together.
Well, maybe. I mean, do you still have the option going, or is the option expired?
No, it expired. I mean, they were about the sixth time we'd sold the Nightside. I mean, it was going to be a series of films at one point. It was going to be a television series. We keep selling it, and it keeps not being made. I can only assume that they look at it, and then at the end they crunch the numbers and say, this is simply so expensive, because it would be. It's packed full of all kinds of weird stuff, which you would need to get the full flavor. But I still have hope.
I would keep pounding the table. I would keep pounding the pavement on that one, because AI is about to make all this stuff a lot cheaper.
Yeah, I always say, I mean, I've got an American agent who's got a sub-agent who deals purely with selling the film rights. We're constantly selling film rights, audio rights, television rights. It's just that nothing ever seems to get made. Endlessly frustrating. Like I said, the one thing I wanted to hear John Carpenter's theme for The Nightside, because I think it should have sounded like a man with a broken heart playing a saxophone under a streetlight at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I think Carpenter could have done that.
In his own Carpenter style, too. You don't even need to know.
Oh,
you
yeah.
can hear a new Carpenter tune, and you don't even need to know it's Carpenter. You just know. It has a certain
sound. Well, he's been
sound
touring,
to it.
playing music with his son. They've been releasing a series of CDs of his music, and he's as good a music writer now as he ever was.
And again, same same style. In terms of movies, The Thing is obviously my all-time favorite, followed closely
Yeah.
by They Live. They Live was a good one too.
That one, I think, was his most overly political movie because it really is about the haves and the have-nots. I still say it's spoiled by that extremely long fight sequence in the middle, which just goes on and on and on. It's one of those things, you know, if I'm watching it, you know, on DVD, it's like, okay, hit the fast forward or hit the jump to next scene because I'm not sitting through this again.
Although I
But
could
it's
watch
got
that.
some nice, oh, fine, if you know, if you like it. But what I liked about it was like the old EC Comics look to it. I mean, when you finally see the aliens, that's something Wally Wood would have drawn back in the 50s. That wonderful, bug-eyed, veiny, horrible, half-decayed-looking creature. It's pure EC Comics, and I loved all that.
I particularly enjoy the subliminal like signage and messaging. Money is your god, you know, like marry and reproduce. I mean, that's some dark stuff.
And every ad just basically says, buy this stuff,
Yeah,
which is
consume.
all ads are anyway.
Yeah, consume. Like everything's consume. So
Oh, yes.
any final words for the audience that you'd like them to know about this book?
I would basically say, whatever you like, you'll find it in the Hyde books. You've got action, you've got horror, you've got a burgeoning romance, you've got extremely funny bits and pieces. If you like it, you'll find it in these books.
All right, Simon, folks, go out and buy this book ASAP. You can find it at anywhere books are sold, Amazon, anywhere, and also leave a review on Amazon if you buy it on Amazon. Even if you don't buy it on Amazon, leave a review on Amazon. The more reviews you leave, the better the book tends to do. So thank you, Simon. It was an absolute pleasure, and I'm glad we fought through all the obstacles. Right? That's what you,
Thank
as writers, we always throw obstacles at other people. But today we had the obstacles and we fought through and we got it done.
Today we went full hide.
That's right. All right. I appreciate you, brother, and talk soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much yourself.
And now we bring you our audiobook serialization of Tinker by Wynne Spencer. Inventor girl genius Tinker lives in a near future Pittsburgh, which now exists mostly in the land of the elves. She runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. When a pack of wargs chase an elven noble into her scrapyard, life as she knows it takes a serious detour. Tinker finds herself taking on the elven court, the NSA, the Elven Interdimensional Agency, technology smugglers, and a college-minded xenobiologist as she tries to stay focused on what's really important, her first date. Armed with an intelligence the size of a planet, steel-toed boots, and a junkyard dog attitude, Tinker is ready to kick butt to get her first kiss.
Chapter 11 Spellstones. Tinker wasn't sure if she was annoyed or relieved to be hustled off center stage. Certainly, she didn't like being the focus of attention, but she would have liked to know more about what was going on. She had a feeling, though, that there was no way she could stay and not be the focus. Sparrow seemed to take the escort duty as badly, though she did try to hide the fact that she was seething. The sprawling layout of the palace translated into a maze of hallways, open courtyards, and short flights of stairs. Armed warriors stood guard everywhere. At first, they only passed Fire Clan warriors, who watched their passage in still silence. But at one intersection of hallways, they apparently moved into Wind Clan territory. From that point on, the warriors all wore Wind Clan blue and bowed low, their gazes curious, although their expressions were neutral. Finally, they entered a large, beautiful room with heavy mahogany furniture. Sparrow paused to state, "This is the private living quarters of Wolf Who Rules. You will be sleeping here until we leave for Pittsburgh," and continued walking through the room. "What? These are the domos and domis' private quarters," Sparrow answered without stopping. This way. She entered a bedroom the size of a baseball field. You will be sleeping here until the Queen gives us permission to leave for Pittsburgh. Tinker paused at the door, her tension caught and fixed by the large bed turned down to show off satin sheets. Did Winwolf plan to sleep with her in it? Surely in a place this large, there was another place he could sleep. Had he just assumed she agreed to it? Or would it be taken badly if she made him sleep elsewhere? How would anyone even know if she did in a place this big? Did she want to sleep with him? Take off the gown, Sparrow stated briskly, and Tinker realized that the female had already repeated herself several times. You only wear that gown for formal occasions. Sparrow held out something white and flowing. This is your nightgown here. Automatically, Tinker started to consider how to get off the gown before she found enough mental stability to realize that one, Pony and an unknown female warrior stood behind her, and two, she didn't want to change into the diaphanous thing that Sparrow held. She crossed her arms and glared at Sparrow. I want my own clothes back. They are being washed. This is all you have to wear other than the gown. Great. Tinker looked back at Pony. He took that as permission to speak on a different matter entirely.
Forgiveness, Zedomi. This female is Sunlance. She is well known to me as brave and able. I have chosen her to attend you in the evening, and those places I cannot join you.
Sunlance bowed low. I live to serve, Zedomi. Tinker felt like someone had kicked the legs out from under her. You're leaving me alone? Even a Sakasha must sleep, Sparrow snapped. He's staggering where he stands as it is. Tinker realized guiltily that Pony was indeed exhausted. He must never really have slept since they left Winwolf's hunting lodge. Of all the idiocy, she muttered in English, and then in Elvish said, Go, sleep. Tinker shooed Pony away. Sparrow waited, nightgown in hand. Now that they were down to just females, Tinker considered how to get out of her gown again, and decided that she couldn't do it alone. Can you help me undo the hooks? It was interesting to note that elves made the same aspirated sounds when they were frustrated. Sparrow tossed the nightgown onto the bed and came to undo the hooks. Her pale, graceful hands were ice cold and trembling. Was she shaken by the news that she had been considered the pivot, or jealous that Tinker took her place once again? If she wanted the position, she could have it back. Tinker carefully wriggled out of the gown, and Sparrow took it up to hang up in a vast, empty closet. While not quite as tight, the nightgown of white fairy silk matched the gown in cut. Long sleeves, tight bodice, and full flowing skirt. It slipped over her head, too, like so much cool air, and spilled down over her body to swirl around her ankles. Despite being fully dressed, she felt naked. She glanced at herself in a mirror across the room and winced. The tight fabric left nothing to the imagination, looking like so much cream poured down over her. You don't have anything else for me to wear? Nothing to lounge in. Sparrow came back with another pair of dainty slippers, these white to match the nightgown. Where are the boots you showed me earlier? Tinker pulled off the bronze slippers and surrendered them to Sparrow's care. The boots are not appropriate to wear in the palace. Where are they? Sparrow looked at her levelly, whatever she felt carefully hidden away, but yet she seemed to radiate distaste. Were elves secretly psychic? After a minute of cold silence, Sparrow said, They're in the closet with the other footwear. Score one for the visiting team. Will that be all? Sparrow asked. Yes, Tinker said, wanting rid of all elves, short-tempered Sparrow in particular. Sparrow nodded, and Sunlance bowed deeply, and at last, Tinker was alone.
That was another installment in Wynn Spencer's Tinker, and that's it for the podcast. Thanks as always to Audible.com and podcast theme composer Ruth Judkowitz, and good night, Tony Daniel, wherever you are. This is David F. Shirod coming to you from a soundproof bunker somewhere deep in the heart of Texas. Join us here next week at the hammering heart of science fiction and fantasy, and keep reaching for the stars.